This week, investors poured equities profits into gold, which blasted higher for the sixth consecutive week in a row, coming within earshot of $1,400 an ounce amid tensions between Russia and the West. Hello, everyone. Your host, Chris Waldseck, back with you this week. And economist and best-selling author Harry S. Dent Jr. expects the rally in the precious metals sector to persist for some time, despite expectations of a deflationary collapse. Driving the deflation theme is the retirement baby boom generation, a mature demographic group that has outgrown the traditional family-oriented spending habits in favor of retirement savings, leading to an imminent reduction in overall domestic output and price inflation. And I open up the phone lines for the caller question and answer segment. Longtime listeners, Mr. Ho, George, Rome, and John, plus first-time callers, share their thought-provoking questions and comments. You can call in your questions and comments via our toll-free hotline 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And you can leave your first name or just remain anonymous if you prefer. 1-800-507-6531. 1-800-507-6531. And Robert Ian returns next week with his latest report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather report. Mostly sunny weather appeared over the precious metals exchanges this week. On Friday, gold futures registered the sixth winning week in a row on news of geopolitical jitters between Russia and the West over the Crimean referendum scheduled for this weekend, and the resulting weaker dollar, which helped gold prices gain more than 3%. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, the yellow metal added about $42, finishing at $13.82. Silver added about 50 cents, closing at $21.46 an ounce. Palladium took a pause this week after outperforming most metals recently, dropping about $10, closing at $7.73, while platinum also gave back $12 after finishing up an impressive run recently, closing at $14.71 an ounce. West Texas Intermediate crude also dropped about $3.50, finishing at $99 a barrel, dropping below the century mark for the first time in 5 weeks. Meanwhile, weekly jobless claims fell to a three-month low, about 315,000, better than expected. Additional good news included improvements in U.S. retail sales, which climbed less than 0.3% in February. That's the first gain in 3 months, topping expectations. Investors sought the safe haven of precious metals amid the Ukraine-Russia standoff. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met with Russian officials with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, but was unsuccessful in his attempt to resolve the standoff in over 6 hours of talks in London amid the impending vote over adding the Crimea Peninsula to the Russian Federation. The referendum to annex Crimea from Russia on Sunday is adding to worries that the crisis will end poorly for the U.S. and Europe. The U.S. and European Union are threatening sanctions against Russia if the annexation plan comes to pass. Russian officials claim that the Federation has no plans, though, to invade the southern regions of Ukraine. However, one analyst expects a situation to erupt in protests if the elections don't go well this weekend, which could send the yellow metal soaring above $1,400 an ounce. Elsewhere, the world's second largest economy is slowing. News out of China that factory output registered the weakest reading in some time and retail sales advanced at the slowest pace in a decade rattled the markets. China's industrial output was up, though, 8.6% from a year earlier. That's compared to expectations of about 9.5%, according to the Dow Jones Newswires. Now, retail sales climbed 11.8%. That was substantially lower than the 13.5% gain. Bank of America economists lowered their expectations and projections. Goldman Investment Group expects the Bank of China, though, to implement an economic stimulus plan. Bottom line on the precious metals. Gold and related stocks broke out to new highs as expected in the last Alpha Stocks newsletter report. For next week's report and all the stock picks, please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account. We have several gold and silver stocks on the radar screen. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, clouds appeared over the New York Stock Exchange this week amid weaker-than-expected consumer confidence numbers. Lower confidence levels coincide with decreased spending, corporate sales, and profits. The U.S. consumer comprises over 70% of national output. For the week, the Dow fell about 43, holding firm, though, above key support at 16,065. The S&P 500 lost 2%, down 36%, ending at 1841. The NASDAQ dropped from last week's 14-year record off 90 points, about 2%, finishing at 43.36. Consumer confidence unexpectedly fell to a four-month low, as did the producer price index, giving the Fed further QE wiggle room. Fed Chair Janet Yellen will tell us more about the Fed's QE plans at the next FOMC meeting, slated for March 18th and 19th next week. The market seemed to be factoring in a somewhat dovish slant, though, for the next FOMC meeting. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, the market did drop this week as forecasted last week. Our 7-component fear index recoiled from extreme greed last week to a more fearful reading, but not quite fearful enough to call a bottom just yet. Caution is advised in the near term. Taking a look at the weekly chart of the NASDAQ, the ascent seems to rival maybe even the 2000 bubble. When this thing implodes, we might see something as epic as the 2000-2002 collapse, or perhaps something even worse. So I think it's something that people need to be considering when taking a look at their portfolios in the next few weeks and months. And coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with my interview with Harry S. Dent Jr., plus all of our listeners' Q&A. So stay with us here for more GoldSeek. So glad you're back with us for another GoldSeek.com radio gold nugget segment. Today's special guest, best-selling author and economist, Harry S. Dent Jr. Welcome back, Harry S. Dent Jr.
Oh, nice to be here.
Well, I wonder if we could begin today with an article you penned recently regarding free markets in today's world. You say that it's all about the consumer today, giving them the freedom to choose what they need instead of what, you know, some expert in a smoky room came up with. The key is innovation. We need to constantly keep improving, learning from lessons and failures. Now, I don't know that that sounds very novel in and of itself. The real point here is we must either get on board with this new paradigm or, as entrepreneurs and small business owners, perish. I wonder if you could give some pointers, some tips to our listeners today, most of whom have probably either started small businesses in the past or will likely do so in the future. Help them craft a business model for success.
Well, you know, what we say is information technologies allow you to run your company from the bottoms up, not the top down, and to organize around customers, not the backline bureaucrats or management and that sort of stuff. So customers should be driving your company. And I just give a quick example. The stock exchanges today, since they're information intensive and all that information can be automated through software, the stock markets, you ring the bell at 9:30 in the morning and run and get out of the way. There's no management, no apparent management. The users drive the system with all their trades and input and access to information. They know exactly what price they got. They know how much profits they made. And the whole system just closes down at the end of the day and starts the next morning again. It's the management, the rules, the bureaucracy, all the information is in the software that operates at light speed. And in a system like that, the users drive the system. Management, nobody tells them what to trade or what information they need. And there's all types of servers they can access and all types of trading systems. And people just do what they do, and the system constantly changes, and nobody can predict what it's going to do. It's an example of the free market system, in broader terms, in everyday business. Now, this is obviously easier if your business is more knowledge or information intensive than if you're moving around a lot of hard goods, but you can still make it more that way. So that's something we look in the new book, The Demographic Cliff. We look at that in Chapter 8. We summarize the network corporation. Then I've got a whole 9-CD system that for small business management that has that as one of the whole modules. But there's another factor, too, today. The free market system at the macro level is not as free market as it used to be because governments have stepped in this crisis and basically said, we're not going to trust free markets. We're not going to let the markets rebalance, deleverage debt, let some businesses fail, and let some others succeed. We're just going to come in and keep the system. We're not going to have recessions. We're not going to have downturns. We're not going to have debt deleveraging. We're not going to have major banks or companies fail. They're basically killing the golden goose from my point of view because the free market system at the macro level for our broader economy, which we, first kind of started in the late 1700s, when democracy and free market capitalism, the Industrial Revolution, kind of married each other, I call it when Harry met Sally, that was the start of a revolution, and we've been in a just a roaring stock market and advance in standard of living and population and urbanization ever since. It's been the biggest advance in our standard of living in history, and it came because of the invisible hand, as Adam Smith called it. And now, in our kind of arrogance, people don't want, we're so soft, we don't want recessions. Okay, we had a big debt bubble. Well, we shouldn't have to go through austerity. Every debt bubble has to deleverage in history. Financial bubbles have to deflate. And that destroys money, and a lot of people get hurt, but it's part of the system, and it also feeds into innovation. Innovation does not occur without extremes of inflation and deflation, boom and bust, and things like that, and, you know, innovation and creative destruction. Our whole system operates on the dynamics of polar opposites, male, female, boom, bust, all these things, you know, and we basically just don't accept that anymore. We want the booms without the busts. We want the bubbles without the burst. We want to be able to borrow a lot of money and never have to, you know, restructure it if it goes bad or have banks fail. If banks lend money against homes worth 10 times people's income, then they should fail. And then when those loans fail and those houses go down in price, they should write down those loans. And that'd be the biggest thing that could help the American consumer and business today. If loans, especially against real estate that has deflated and will deflate more by our projections in another great downturn ahead, that's the best thing that could free up cash flow when the economy is not so good. Instead of stimulating the economy with funny money and printing money out of, you know, thin air, basically the governments should give the banks just enough assistance so they don't all fall down and force them to mark loans down to market and take their losses and restructure and do whatever they have to do and let the strong survive. That's what the economy does. If we don't allow that, then we end up in a coma economy like the Japanese have been in now for 23 years, going on 24 years, and I cover that in Chapter 2. What happens when you don't let debt deleverage, you don't let the system rebalance, and you keep the status quo through endless QE? That's what the Japanese have already been doing long before us. They started in 1997. We started in 2009. So they're 12 years ahead of us. They're 12 years ahead of us in their baby boom peak and their bubbles bursting and all this sort of stuff. So Japan shows us what happens if we kill the golden goose. And now here we're doing it in Europe, United States, and China's totally economy is almost 100% run by its government. And they got the biggest overbuilding cycle in history, the greatest real estate bubble in modern history. And when China blows, it's going to blow so bad. And I think the cracks are showing now. I think China's going to start to blow by the end of this year, if not earlier. And it's going to fall like an elephant. And it's going to be something that central banks can't prevent in the developed world, since it's outside of their scope, with just printing more money. So I think you got a big crisis coming. But what we say for businesses, like you start out saying, here's a whole new paradigm, and the best businesses are already doing this. Stock exchanges, software companies, Google, companies like that, they already operate like this, bottoms up. They don't have all the bureaucracy and top-down management, you know, their consumers drive. This is the way to survive. The companies that survive the crisis I see ahead, which is going to be a lot like the 1930s, where a lot of businesses go under, a lot of banks go under, is if you're still standing at the end of this, you inherit the world. You're going to have high market share and much fewer competitors, and you're going to do well for decades. So to me, this is the most opportune time, the next 6 years, when all of my cycles point down at the same time, like in the 1930s. It's the most opportune time in history and in our lifetimes, and it's also the most challenging. So the key is seeing it coming and knowing what to do so you do survive.
It all ties together then with Adam Smith and the Wealth of Nations when you start to talk about the invisible hand. I call it the training wheel economy. Eventually, the training wheels have to come off, but they don't want to take the training wheels off. They don't want anybody to fall down. Big Brother can't be behind you, making sure that the bicycle stays steady forever. Eventually, we have to be on our own. And the ramifications of that is market equilibrium disappears. There is no real supply and demand. And as I think you alluded to earlier, that's the fundamental basis of the Industrial Revolution and of the economic miracle that began in the 1800s.
I think China has taken the top-down model. They've come in and said, we're going to plan our economy, we're going to move people, we're going to target the industries we want to go to. I mean, they have moved, just in the last 12 years, 220 million people, you know, 25% of their workforce, I mean, from rural to urban areas. These are people with low skills. They don't really fit in. They're moving them into condos they can't really afford. They're taking their old land and selling it to developers. That's how they make money short term. They're creating this government run. It's called state-driven capitalism. Now, economists think that is the new model. I think what China's going to do is prove that such a top-down model does not succeed. It hasn't in history. I mean, the Soviet Union tried it. China's tried it for decades. It is not the model of the future. The model is even more than in the 1800s and 1700s when we started this. Information technologies just allow the free capitalistic bottoms-up model, which has been working for the best countries in the world and in Europe, the United States. It's what made us rich, and including Japan and Korea. China's not following that model, and I think they're making a huge mistake, and I think they're going to fail so badly that nobody, economists, don't ever come out in the future and say, oh, state-driven, top-down-driven capitalism is better. Information technologies just make it even more powerful to use bottoms-up methods at the macro level. But what I'm saying, what's different this time, companies have always run from the top down, despite our bottoms-up economy increasingly. Information technology is going to allow companies, individual companies and networks of companies to operate from the bottoms up. And that's the network principle. Networks operate from the bottoms up. Nature operates from the bottom up. There's no king of the jungle running things. It's this whole bottoms up process that evolves and innovates and progresses. And so everything's on that principle. So I think China is going in exactly the wrong direction, and they're going to fail miserably.
Now, you're arguably a leading researcher in the field of market demographics, and I'd like for you to maybe to give our listeners an overview of what your trends are showing you right now and how investors should be positioning their portfolios.
We were the only ones in the late 80s, 1989, in my first book, to predict the simultaneous collapse of Japan in the 90s and the greatest boom in history for the United States and Europe and other Western countries. And we saw that from demographics. My simple theory back then, and we've refined it more since, is that what drives the economy in modern times with middle-class kind of economies in developed countries is simply that new generations like the baby boom or the Bob Hope generation before them and, you know, move up a predictable cycle of entering the workforce at age 20, earning, spending more money as they get married, have kids, buy houses, borrow, and all this stuff. And they peak today. We can quantify it. About age 46 in the U.S., 47 it looks like in most other countries in Europe and in Japan, just because our immigrants bring down our kind of education levels and peak spending just a little bit on average. The baby boom, real simple. I mean, I developed an indicator in 1988 called the spending wave. I just moved forward the birth index 46 years for the peak in spending. So in other words, you're born at age zero. 46 years later, you'll have your biggest impact on the economy through spending and things like that. And it correlates with the economy, and that would have set a boom from 1983 to 2007. Well, that's exactly what happened. I mean, I wasn't even looking for it to be that exact. And then a downturn from 2008 into 2020, kind of flattening out in 2023. Then the next generation, which is not as large, by the way, will drive another boom, and it will not be as dynamic as the baby boom boom, as the 50s and 60s boom from the Bob Hope generation was not as dynamic as the 83 to 2000 boom, because the baby boom was so large. And the baby boom was so large that in my consulting work with businesses, you know, I was forced to look at baby booms, this new generation, this new market for my business clients, and I studied them up and down. I realized, oh my gosh, this is a giant generation. And for the first time in history back then, in the early 80s, the government was starting to survey households, 600 categories every year, and I know when they're going to buy cakes or potato chips or camping equipment, nevertheless buy a house or a car or spend the most money at age 46 or invest, you know, have the highest net worth at age 64 and borrow the most at age 41. And so it makes our economy very predictable, not just the macro level, but businesses can see shifting sectors in the consumer sectors that drive their business. And even if you don't deal directly with consumers, every business at the end is driven by consumer sectors. So you can tell when people are going to buy small cars and then, you know, luxury cars and pickup trucks you know, when they're going to shift to these different stages of buying, when they're going to buy, you know, when they're going to need apartments, starter homes, trade-up homes, McMansions, you know, vacation homes, when they're going to need nursing homes. I mean, on and on and on. So you can see how consumers are going to shift your markets and be ahead. I mean, I'll give you an example. And we predicted this way back in 2005, that the housing bubble was peaking in late 2005, and it peaked just after that. Housing peaks first in the life cycle, even before peak spending. Then furniture and furnishings peak at that age 46 peak. And the last big purchase to peak is automobiles at age 53. We're going to see that peak this year in the U.S. Automobiles are suddenly going to dive off a cliff, just like housing did many years ago. And at the same time they dive off a cliff, recreational vehicles, RVs, are going to have their biggest surge in history. Most of those are bought between age 53 and 60. So that's the type of things you can see. I mean, if I was in that kind of business, I tell you the truth, I'd be selling some car dealerships and buying some RV dealerships selling car stocks and buying RV stocks. And so that's the type of insights you can get. Demographics are the most projectable thing. And in an economy that for the first time is dominated by everyday consumers that have, you know, $50,000, $60,000 average incomes, which they didn't have 100 years ago, and then can borrow and mortgage 80, 90% against their house, which they couldn't do, you know, several decades ago. It demographics is a bigger driver than it was in the past. So I just happened to trip on this in the late 70s, early 80s in my consulting. I ended up becoming an economist by the late 80s because I realized, oh, my gosh, I've discovered the holy grail here. We even tie inflation to the cost of raising kids and entering them into the workforce for parents, governments, and businesses. All have to make that investment, and then they get in and they become productive. I mean, you know, kids cost everything and produce nothing. That is inflation, and we correlate the entire inflation surge that peaked in 1980 to the baby boomers entering the workforce in massive numbers. And as soon as they fully entered the workforce and workforce growth went down, we had disinflation. And now we're going to have deflation for many reasons, but that's one of them. So we even tie inflation and deflation to demographics. In other words, we don't look to the government to say, where's our economy going 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now? We look to demographics, and then what governments do is react. When there's too much inflation, then they tighten interest rates and raise them. When there's too much disinflation or deflation, then they stimulate the economy and print money to try to react. When there's recession, they try to react. You know, when a boom gets too hot or a bubble, they try to react. But they're not driving these trends. Demographics and technologies, we track technologies with the generation cycle. Innovate when young, adopt those technologies when you're growing up, earning, spending money, and then change institutions when you're older and have all the power. So all of this goes back to demographics.
The epiphany that you had with demographics in the, I guess, late 70s, early 80s, certainly coincides almost identically to the moment of Satori that I had when I realized that all markets enter protracted periods of autocorrelation or serial correlation, colloquially referred to as trends, market trends. When you realize that although it only occurs, let's say, 30% of the time, but it's fractal in nature, it occurs from the tick level all the way up to the monthly and yearly data, and that all protracted profitable moves essentially are trends, and that every market eventually will enter either an uptrend or a downtrend, talk about the holy grail you referred to. What I would recommend is you must augment that strategy with a long-term weekly or monthly trend component on, let's say, a 20 or 50 period exponential moving average. It would be like the combination of Kasparov and Big Blue working together, financial dynamite. But anyway, you know, I'm way off topic here, and I'd like to shift over to the markets because that's what our listeners would like to hear. And you know, last week the Labor Department threw the markets a curveball with the unemployment rate climbing to 6.7%, up a tick from 6.6% the markets had factored in, lower unemployment, and of course an end to QE. Do you expect the Fed to wrap up QE operations this year?
Yeah, I think they're, for now, they want to go step by step, and they don't want to look like they're rash. So, yeah, the economy's slowing in some sectors, and we've been predicting this, because every time there's a stimulus cycle, we find that the economy grows for three or four quarters, up to as high as 4%, and then it goes right back down to zero for the next three or four quarters. And everybody acts like it's a sustainable recovery. It's only sustainable if you keep upping QE. So this is really a false perception. So I think the economy is slowing, and it is more than weather. But it's going to take them a while to see that. They're going to have to look at the spring data and say, oh, now that the weather's good, if it's still slowing, yeah, they're going to stop. I think they're just going to put a halt to tapering at first, and then they might even step up again. I just don't think this time it's going to matter. I think they've stretched the economy as far as they can stretch it. 5 years is as long as any bull market's gone, except for the 1990 to 2000 bull market, which was extreme byproduct of strong technology and the best decade of baby boom spending here. But, you know, they basically they've stretched it as far as they can. China bubble's about to blow. Germany looks worse than Japan did to us in 1989 when we saw their demographic cliff coming. And that's one of the points of the new book, is that baby boom's peaking, but it's peaking at different times around the world. It peaked in Japan between late 89 and late 96, kind of a double peak, and then they went off the cliff. And they've been on QE and coma economy ever since. And then it peaked in the U.S., as we predicted 20 years ago, in late 2007. And we've been fighting headwinds ever since. Europe, baby boom, even though they're aging faster than us and have more older people, their baby boom actually peaked in most countries later than the United States. And Germany's going to go off that cliff this year. Germany's going to be the surprise of the decade, along with China. China's workforce has already peaked, the only emerging country that has slightly slowing workforce for the next decade and then much slower after that. They're the first emerging country to peak in demographics. But Germany goes off the steepest cliff of any single country, even steeper than Japan's, in the 1990s for spending. So Germany and China are going to be the two big surprises. Germany's supposed to hold up the European Union, and they got the worst demographics of anybody. And I don't care how competitive they are in exports. And by the way, their exports have turned negative now. China's have turned, or down 18% in the last month, turned vastly negative. World trade has been slowing. And in countries that export strongly, like China and Germany, are going to get hit the worst. And Korea's the worst of those, 50% of its GDP. So we got some big shocks coming. And I think we're getting very close to a market peak. The market just doesn't get this yet. But, it's been tumbling a little bit since that China data came out. But there's no way Germany's not going to do poorly in the next decade, especially between 2014 and 2022. They have a steep drop in spending that has nothing to do with government stimulus or exports or competitiveness. It's just people are going to slow down because their kids leave the nest. They don't slow down because they retire, so you can't even cure it with later retirement, although that would help. What causes this drop in spending is when the kids leave the nest, you just don't need to spend money on a lot of things, from cars to houses to furniture to education, food. I mean, the kids drive everything.
2014 is shaping up to be a good year for the precious metals. Still considerable overhead resistance, though. Right now, we see weakness in the U.S. dollar as the greenback just has missed every opportunity to rally sharply over the last 3 years. You know, we're watching $1,500 gold as, for, you know, overhead resistance, and $26 to $30 silver for signs of a breakout. If we can eclipse those levels, we might have the makings of a recovery. What levels are you watching for signs that this three-year reaction is over and the bulls are back in charge, please?
Yeah, I see that. I think gold is going to rally for a while, maybe months. And 1430 is the first resistance I see, because that's the recent high after its first kind of bounce, after its first breakdown. But what it broke, the key trend in gold is it broke out of a sideways channel between 1800 and 1525. And frankly, the surge it had into that channel would have suggested that gold should have stayed in that channel and broken to the upside, not the downside. So breaking to the downside was not a good sign. So the ultimate upside resistance is close to what you said, 1525. I think it's going to be very hard for gold to get above that. It may not even get that far in my estimation, but if it does, if gold can break above 1525 and stay above there for some period of time, then it's likely headed a good bit higher. I tend to think that when the economy goes down, you're going to see two things that people don't expect. I think you're going to see deflationary trends like we saw in the late 2008, early 2009, and that's not good for gold and silver. And that is good for the U.S. dollar. The dollar, the yen's been tending to go down the most because they're stimulating the strongest, and then the U.S. In the middle, and then Europe, who stopped stimulating, stopped QE after early 2012, after being the strongest. And that's why the euro's been going up. So euro's been going up, dollar's kind of in the middle, sliding down, and the yen's been going down the most until recently. But when things reverse and go down, and when we see a deflationary debt crisis in the world, we're going to destroy more U.S. dollars than any currency because we're the currency out there, and we've created more debt than any other country.
Now, when you say deflationary trend similar to 2008-2009, I mean, is it possible that you're really referring to disinflation? Look at the amount of money printed by the Federal Reserve, their balance sheet now in excess of $4.1 trillion, plus the ECB and the BOC and the BOE.
No, that's why they did that, Chris. Money supply, M3 in the U.S., actually contracted 6% when Lehman Brothers and things were melting down, and we deleveraged something like $4 trillion in private debt in a matter of months. That's exactly, you're right, what the governments did. They stepped in and inflated to counter that deflation, and they've been inflating ever since. But the thing is, the reason gold has gotten weakened since early 2013 is the U.S. stepped up QE3 and then QE3 infinity, and then the Japanese came behind them and tripled their stimulus. I mean, went off, and gold went up at first, and I would have too. I'm saying, well, how inflationary can you get? Inflation dropped from 2% to 1% after that. In other words, the market started getting that. To me, the bigger trend is deflation, and yes, governments are inflating, but they're inflating to fight inflation. We had natural inflation in the 70s, and governments were raising interest rates to fight it. Now they're lowering interest rates and printing money to fight deflation because they don't want to have a depression. A depression is a debt deleveraging. A depression is financial bubbles bursting. All of those things destroy money and wealth. And when you destroy money and wealth, there's less dollars chasing the same goods. And that's the definition of deflation.
There's never been this amount of unbacked paper and electronic money. Even Keynes would be boggled by this astounding amount of money. Now, and then we have a stagflation, if you will. Then we have this massive economic implosion we're starting to see in cities like Detroit and Memphis and so many areas around our country as the municipalities just implode. As you say, Japan struggling, China, former engines of the global growth are struggling right now. And you even say Germany is going to be struggling. Could people be misinterpreting deflation?
The governments don't calculate this right, even though the basic trends are there. We've had disinflation ever since 1980, and it's gone down to somewhere near zero. And our demographic indicators told me that back in 1989 when I developed the inflation indicator. It's just it follows workforce growth on a 2.5-year lag, and it correlates better than any other factor I've found with inflation. And basically, there's three things that cause deflation. Well, there's actually four things. New technologies that bring down the cost of the basic goods, like the Model T back in the roaring semiconductor chips and all this sort of stuff. It brings down the cost of a lot of goods. That's disinflationary or deflation. An aging society, young people are inflationary because you have to invest in them and it costs too much to incorporate them. Old people basically downsize everything. They stay in the same home or downsize. They pay down their mortgage. They drive their car 6,000 miles a year instead of 15,000 miles, so it lasts 10 years instead of 4 years. You know, they save instead of spend. You know, they're not investing. They're basically deflating. Aging generations. You've seen Japan in a deflationary trap for 20 some years now, and they've been doing QE for 17 years. And they're still at zero to slightly negative inflation on average. Printing money alone is not enough to create inflation, is what I'm saying.
Okay. But in that scenario, though, why do we see so much of this legislation being written into virtually every country in Europe and now, you know, working its way in the United States and Canada with regard to bail-ins to municipalities and federal governments? Obviously, the next bailout is going to be 100% on the shoulders of the people, not just our progeny's future, which is essentially what happened in 2008, where we said, well, we'll just borrow ad infinitum from our future. Now we're going to take what you all have saved up in the next bailout. That's what I see coming down the pike, and I'd like your thoughts.
What it's saying to me is government officials and economists are basically saying, we don't trust the free market system anymore. We think we can run it better, just like China thinks they can run, their government can run an economy better than the free market systems with some minor regulations. And they're killing the golden goose. And yes, they're going to keep bailing out stuff. What's happened since 2008, where debt first peaked is that government debt's gone up $7 trillion, not counting municipalities, so it's probably more like $8 or $9 trillion. And private debt went down at first $4 trillion. That's come back up. It's only down about $2 trillion. We have like something like $7 trillion more dollars in debt in total than we had before the debt crisis started. So all they're doing is adding debt to a debt crisis, kicking off the debt deleveraging and deleveraging of the economy and financial assets down the road. Now stock markets are even higher. Now net worth for households is even higher. Now the income inequality that goes to the top 5 to 10% is even higher than it was in 2007. They've just basically kept the bubble going, and they're doing it with money printing, which is debt, creating money out of thin air, however you do it, money printing or banks just creating loans or governments just creating bonds. You're creating money out of thin air, and they're trying to cure debt with a debt crisis, and they're trying to keep a bubble going forever. This is going to go down in history when the government of France basically financed swampland in Mississippi to get to buy it with low interest rates, created a bubble, and basically they were doing this to pay off their war debts. It was just like, and it was done by the first central bank under John Law. And this is going to look like this in history, only worse. It's being done on a larger scale. And if we're printing money, and it's not that China's not printing money, they are printing some money, and they're, now they have a shadow banking system that's going to kill them. But China is doing more than that. China's printing condos and infrastructures. They're just building stuff for nobody. That's even worse. Another cause of deflation is excess capacity. If there's too much capacity in an industry or a country, then you're going to have to lower prices to clear that inventory. So it's just like, this is everything I see is a disaster in the making, and yet most people, including Warren Buffett, God bless his soul, he may be the best investment manager, he doesn't understand the free market system any more than economists do, and he's saying all this money printing and staving off the crisis and covering over with money is fine and everybody should be investing. He is going to lose his reputation big time. People trust him more than any single person financially in this country. He's going to lose the American people's trust. He's telling them it's okay, and it ain't okay. He used to say, I don't even look at the economy. I don't understand it. You know, and I buy really good long-term companies when they're at really good value, and that's what I do. I don't care about the economy. I don't try to predict it. And now he gets on TV on CNBC, and everybody loves him because he's the hero. And now he's talking about the economy, and he just doesn't know what he's talking about. And he's going to mislead these poor people, and he's not meaning to do that. He just doesn't understand that he doesn't know what he's talking about, and he's trying to be a cheerleader for the U.S. government, and he gets all these preferential deals. Sure, I would have bought Goldman Sachs in a crisis if I got the top 10% before everybody else, and I couldn't fail even if they went bankrupt. Sure, he invested. My prediction, real clear, in the next few months, and I only give it that long, you know, by early to mid-May at the latest, that the stock market's going to peak around 17,000 on the Dow, and 2 to 3 years from now, the next stop is 5,000 to 6,000.
Yeah, it's not too far from my projection. And the next consolidation target that I've got is 18,000 to 18,500, probably coincide with the NASDAQ that just touches that, you know, year 2000, 5,000 mark one more time, and then they pull the rug right out from underneath. And where the real money will be made, of course, is shorting the bubble. They love shorting the bubble, the powers that be. Harry S. Dent Jr., I wonder if you could tell folks more about the services that you provide at HS Dent and any contact information you'd like to provide with the listeners today.
Yeah, we have a new book came out in early January, The Demographic Cliff. Best place to get that's Amazon. They got the lowest price, and they usually ship for free if you do the right things. We have a free newsletter that's daily, high content, that lets people just get to know us. It's called Survive and Prosper. All you got to do is go to harrydent.com, put in your email, you're on. It's a great newsletter. You can't go wrong with that. And then we have successive newsletters, Boom and Bust, Dent Leading Edge, that people, once they get to know us, can subscribe at higher levels. But we just let people get to know us first. So the best thing to do is go to harrydent.com and just learn more what we're thinking, because we're like you. We are not thinking like everybody else. And I'm telling people, you better start thinking contrary here, because everybody's getting on this boat, like you said, that this Titanic that's getting ready to go down again. And we've already seen this happen every 6 or 7 years. I mean, people act like, you'd be predicting this. You're too bearish. I'm like, this is what's already happened for the last 15 years. Bubble, burst, bigger bubble, bigger burst, bigger bubble, bigger burst. I think this is the last bubble to burst, and I think we're going to take out this whole money printing and all this leverage, and then we can go back to being normal people in a normal economy with normal housing prices and normal asset prices, and then we can grow again. And normal debt levels. We're way too much in debt.
Debt is out of control. I mean, if we look at it not only as a society, but our home debt as well, the typical family has enormous bills, not only from education, but credit card. I mean, we're talking about enormous levels that just has to be cleared through the system. Again, we've got the contact information for people. They can find all of your information and they can get a copy of your latest book, probably in digital format as well, on Amazon.com. So direct your web browsers there, please. All right. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thank you, Chris.
Okay, it's great to be back with you for another GoldSeek.com Radio Gold Nugget segment. In today's segment, we take calls from longtime listeners and several first-time callers. All right, it's time to open up the phone lines for the listener Q&A segment.
Hi, Chris. It's Ho from Southern California. Long time no talk, but you know I've been listening because we email now and then, and you know how far back I go with this show. Anyway, two things. You had a phone call from a gentleman named John last week. He was concerned about capital controls and about the stopping of the international money wires by a number of the big banks, and he wondered how this might affect things. Well, here's something I've heard through the grapevine, through some dealers that I deal with, which is that they were saying that when they were short of gold, they could just order it from Switzerland, from Asia, from Europe, from wherever. But with the international banking wires being halted, they can no longer get gold when they want it, which would suggest, at least to me, that when there is a run on gold, they're going to discover it's much more difficult to get physical gold than anybody suspects. Right now, nobody's looking for it in that much quantity that I can tell. But as soon as the public's interest gets ignited, they will discover that these dealers cannot supply them as quickly as they might like. Another thing that I think is also very interesting. This week, I went into the bank. I don't keep much money in the bank. I only keep enough in there to pay my bills. And I went in, and I thought, I'm going to throw some cash at it as well, just to make sure there's enough in the account. So I had 520s that I put into the bank. After I did, the teller looked at me and said, "Do you have ID?" I said, "Do you really think I'd put $100 into somebody else's bank account?" And she said, "No, but it's now a requirement." I asked why. She said the government had asked them to do this. And she slid across to me a little glossy piece of paper from Chase. This is Chase, but I'm sure other banks are going to do it. It says, "Important news about cash deposits. When making a cash deposit, please deposit only into personal accounts that list your name. Be ready to show a valid ID for deposits to personal and business accounts." I think that's mind-boggling. They're already trying to figure out where all the cash is and keep an eye on it. Why? We can speculate on that. One of my ideas is that maybe when they finally pull the plug, they want to know where the dollars are and be able to watch who moves cash where. I don't know what it's about, Chris, but it sure is odd to me that they're watching every little bit of cash that gets deposited into their banks. You take care. Bye-bye.
Well, first up, it's Mr. Ho, our longest listener, quite possibly. He is concerned about capital controls. He noted that the dealers do not have the gold within the distribution network that was in place decades ago to cover the impending melt-up. He also noticed that the bank requires a photo ID to make deposits. Well, Mr. Ho, you know, the problem of capital controls is global in scale. It continues, I think, to threaten the safety of every American. I've been posting articles on my Alpha Stocks newsletter for, it's got to be over a year now, showing how wide scale the problem has become. Most obvious examples are in Europe, where we've seen bail-in legislation, in Italy, Bulgaria, Poland, Cyprus. We all know about the Cypriot event, and several other countries. And now it's been written into Canada's legislation overtly and covertly within the United States. So I think the issue is only exacerbated by the fact that central banks cannot even trust each other with their funds. You know, there's no honor among the thieving ranks. You may have heard that the Bundesbank has melted the few tons that has actually arrived from the vaults in New York. Officials noted that the bars needed to be melted and recast. What does this mean? How do we interpret this? You can decide what it means, but here's a one-word hint. Tungsten. You know, tungsten-filled bars have been a problem for not just decades, but for millennia. It goes all the way back to the time of the great Greek scientist Archimedes, who was charged to find out if his king's crown was solid gold. Now, as for photo IDs for making a bank deposit, the next time somebody asks me for ID at a bank simply to make a deposit, I think I might say, well, I was going to ask to use the public restroom, but I'm concerned that it might require an ID to make a deposit.
Hello, Chris. This is Ken in the state of Georgia. I really enjoyed your latest show with Rob Kirby and Peru Saxena. I have a question for you. Was Peru Saxena and you seem to concur that price is the ultimate transmission of market participants, all the market participants' knowledge? So therefore, it's superior to each and one individual's perception, is what I gathered from that. So, but with the interview with Rob Kirby, he seemed to indicate that the price is manipulated. So the knowledge of the market being correct would be if each person had access to the same information, and then the market could be correct. But some people have better knowledge and therefore have more insight. So I kind of would, it just does not seem perfect. A perfect marketplace, because we know a lot of things are manipulated and the price is not a correct transmission of all the participants in the market, because all the participants don't have access to the same information. So that was kind of my question, and if you kind of highlight on that. Rob Kirby seemed to contradict some of the information that was presented in the other interview. So enjoy the show tremendously. Thank you.
Up next, Ken says he wants to know about market price validity. Hi, Ken. You know, the topic that you raise is an important component of my PhD dissertation, currently about 118 pages in length. Now, without getting into a deep philosophical discussion, let's just use a simple, everyday, empirically based example. For instance, if you think the silver market is manipulated, there are many signs that it is. The spot price simply does not reflect the true supply and demand equilibrium levels. Now, if this is the case, then why isn't silver trading at $50 or $100 an ounce at alternative exchanges like eBay? You know, there's currently no law to restrain the price of silver on eBay. We did see silver trading nearly 10 over spot in the past few years, but nothing like the price that some overly optimistic enthusiasts have suggested. Now, although I do agree that there is likely manipulation using derivatives to suppress the price, I expect these positions to unwind in an orderly fashion over the next few years, supporting the price uptrend and culminating with at least three-digit silver. But I do sleep better at night knowing that a bag of silver coins cannot be rehypothecated. Thanks, Ken. Next, it's first-time caller Gary from Atlanta. He says that the gold-to-silver ratio is simply too high. First off, let me say hello to our growing audience in the greater Atlanta and North Georgia area. Gary, this is an issue I've pondered for a decade, and I do have a few thoughts. You are correct that gold is hoarded and typically silver is consumed. Now, this does create a paradox. On the one hand, there is more gold above ground than silver in storage. But on the other, there is much more scrap silver available, and silver in small trinkets and tiny increments that shows up to be melted during any major spike for the metal. Now, this is what we might refer to as shadow inventory. As that shadow inventory continues to work its way slowly through the system over the next few years, I do suspect that it will be similar to a, well, let's think of it as a diver bouncing on the diving board. Each drop lower he gains more momentum until finally he pushes off and leaps skyward. Similarly, I think as scrap dwindles and secondary mining operations from copper decline, silver will be consumed far less and hoarded much more. Now, the gold-to-silver ratio could then approach, let's say, 16 to 1 or even 10 to 1. We could create a hypothetical situation here. Some sources claim that a rural situation, now that's world without rule of law, that silver could become more valuable than even gold due to the need for small transactions. The Vikings, you might recall, much preferred silver over gold due in part to its antimicrobial qualities. Here's another interesting scenario. If an apocalyptic situation unfolds where global currencies fail and global economic trade grinds to a halt, how would mines operate? If mining stopped, suddenly gold could be much more plentiful than silver, since silver is such a byproduct of the mining of copper, nickel, and related metals. Theoretically, the gold-to-silver ratio could actually be reversed, not just reach parity, but reverse, dropping from 50 to 1, let's say to 1 to 10, or even 1 to 50. This is pure speculation, but I think it is something to keep in the back of one's mind, especially for those of us who never intend to part with their precious metals, their physical metals, and hopefully pass it down to our progeny.
This is George again, Chris. What I want to say is there were few analysts, if any, that believed when the Federal Reserve first began QE that it would not adversely impact the dollar and by consequence have a positive impact on gold. But gradually it became evident that all this liquidity being created by the Fed, the velocity of money, M2, was trending down and there was no inflationary impact. Now that quantitative easing has demonstrated it has had very little effect on the U.S. stock market except to create bubbles, what's next for gold? The Asian demand has a put under gold, but is this huge worldwide demand enough to take out future resistance levels without inflation rising in the United States? My belief is there will be insignificant inflation as long as the banks can hold on to these reserves because the money's not entering the economy. I guess I'm going the wrong way around the barn to ask you for gold to rise significantly. Is inflation necessary in the United States? Or will the worldwide loss of confidence in fiat currency turn the tide? Thank you very much.
Next at bat, longtime listener George. He says that QE has done little to help the domestic economy, but has certainly created several financial bubbles, endangering the reserve currency status of the U.S. dollar. Well, hi, George. You know, all this talk about QE tapering does appear to be smoke and mirrors. In reality, the Fed's balance sheet, as I'm sure you know, has not shrunk one iota. In fact, it continues to grow, over $4.15 trillion to date. I'm watching that metric closely, as well as the labor participation rate, which does look like a sinkhole. If folks can't find solid, meaningful work that lasts longer than the holiday season, the new housing bubble will likely implode. That could take down the remnants of the nascent economic recovery. This, in turn, will send money out of stocks and real estate directly into the precious metals. All right. Thanks, George. Look forward to your next question.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for all your hard work. This is Rome, Portland, Oregon. I just wanted to ask, you've interviewed Jim Rogers a couple of times in the last few months, and he mentioned that China was having a huge meeting vetting their 25-year plan. I was wondering if you had any more information where I could track that down. I would like to have a clear idea of what China's planning in the next 20, 30, 40 plus years. So, once again, thanks for the great show. What's the great part? And I thought your interview with Rick Rule was fantastic. Thank you. Bye.
And we have Rome from Portland. He'd like to know China's plans for the next quarter century. I did see that China has considerable plans regarding gold. Not only is it now the largest consuming nation and the largest producing nation, but we really don't know exactly how much gold they are importing and stockpiling. Like the Fremen from Herbert's six-book Dune series, the society seems to understand that the only way to change the face of Arrakis is to accumulate as much of the metal as possible and divest worthless currencies. Now, if the current trend continues, I estimate that China will eclipse the U.S. reserve stockpile, gold that is, currently the largest in the world, sometime around 2020. Of course, this could happen even sooner simply because we don't know exactly how much they have. They don't report their gold reserves in the same fashion as Western countries. And if my memory serves, it has been nearly 5 years, I want to say 2008, 2009, since their last gold stockpile update. Good to hear from you, Rome, and thanks for that interesting question.
Hi, Chris. John from Downers Grove, Illinois again calling. I just wanted to once again thank you for your great show and listen to it every week, and also to make a commentary on other market pundits. I hardly listen to those fellas anymore because they really sound like they become, I just heard on this week's broadcast or webcast over there at their shop, they're saying that gold is, basically they're making it sound like gold is having a dead cat bounce and that gold is going to be dead. They could confiscate all your profits from gold and all these other scary things that are going to happen to people that buy gold and silver. I remember when Jim was really hot on silver at one time. I mean, he used to have David Morgan on every single week. And gradually, the folks over at his shop, they are pushing away from all the gloom and doom, even though we are in the greatest bubble in history. And they know that. So I just assume they're talking their book because they make a lot more money if they're selling their services to people who are mainstream. They're not making enough money selling it to people who really know what's coming down the pike. I'm not saying that you shouldn't have a balanced portfolio, but the Federal Reserve does not have a clue. They don't know what they're doing. You listen to a person like Peter Schiff or Richard Russell, and it's like they're living on two different planets. I mean, you don't even recognize them. Disinflation, leading economic indicators, all that malarkey that we hear out of the mainstream Wall Street media. It's just unbelievable. But anyway, I didn't mean this to turn into a rant about, I just want to let you know that we really appreciate what you do. And not that we need people preaching to the choir. We don't need that. We need balance. But obviously, things are really starting to unwind here. Keep up the good work. Bye-bye.
Next, it's another longtime listener, John from Illinois. He's concerned by competing gold radio shows that apparently were formerly bullish on the sector, but have now switched over into the bearish camp, promoting stocks instead. Well, first off, great to hear from you, John. I have an Uncle John who lives not too far from your town. Incidentally, I haven't listened to the shows you mentioned in several years, mostly because they monetized them. So I really only have your word to go by, but I'm sure that their listeners have done quite well with stocks, like many of my Alpha Stocks newsletter subscribers. We've been long the equities markets for the better part of 3 years by following, you know, the weekly and monthly trends, as well as keeping an eye on market sentiment, which did get quite frothy last week. I warned my subscribers, and we had a subsequent sell-off this week. So sentiment, in my opinion, and the trend just rule the equity markets better than virtually any other sector I've come across. As for the precious metals, I think the key levels here we need to climb back over are $1,500 on gold and $30 for silver. Once this occurs, hedge funds and money managers will regain confidence, and the public will too, likely sending the metals back to the 2011 peak for a retest. That's about as forward-looking as I'd like to be at this time. The fundamental outlook, I think, is much more enticing. I mean, let's forget for a moment the insatiable global demand and the limited supply, not to mention currency issues, particularly the weak U.S. dollar, which should be, I think, 30% higher than it is right now. The fact that the dollar is not higher, I think, speaks volumes. It simply had every opportunity to be the investment du jour. We've had deflationists on this show for years, calling for this giant dollar rally, and it's just on the verge of collapse. It's on its way to 70. Once we break that level, I think you will see gold move 50 to 100% higher very quickly. I think the decline in the U.S. dollar once we break through 70, and I have to admit, these sentiments are directly from Jim Sinclair. So don't take my word on it. I mean, if you love Jim Sinclair, as we all do, clearly it's more than likely going to come to pass. But ignoring this mountain of evidence, personally, I think the case for gold is still a home run. due to the threat of savings confiscation and pension fund confiscation via bail-ins and brokerage rehypothecation. The term rehypothecation really only took off after the MF Global phenomenon. Before that, you know, it sounded like a geeky grammar term, you know, something you forgot on an English exam, maybe to rehypothecate your sentence. So how many novel ways will the powers that be find to confiscate the minuscule amount of money that we're able to tuck away each month under our beds? Well, I think most of us have been working for decades. I started paying Social Security 30 years ago. I was 15 years old. I've been paying every year since then, as of this June. But with runaway grocery prices, high energy cost, soaring education cost, and I can attest to that, the general cost of living has just reached levels that most people can't manage. It has eviscerated the middle class, as seen by the explosive increase in use of, well, SNAP debit cards or food stamps. And a few of us, I think, have anything left over at the end of the month for our savings. But you can be sure that the powers that be behind the scenes will find a method that will, well, exsanguinate the last drop from our financial bodies.
Hi, Chris. This is Robert. I'm calling from Oregon. Okay, my question today is regarding banks. We're all aware that the FDIC that insures banks, that the FDIC is fundamentally insolvent. So to minimize risk, I've headed towards credit unions. And we know that there's a four-letter insurance agency run by the government that insures credit unions against insolvency. So I was wondering if you could have your guests comment on the status of that agency that insures the credit unions, and whether or not your guests feel that credit unions are a safer alternative, or whether the credit unions are subject to the same sort of bail-ins that we expect our standard American banks to be suffering eventually. Chris, thank you so much for the show. I've been listening for years. People like Bob Chapman and you that have helped me keep a grip on the true situation in the American housing market. And because of that, thank you. A low net worth individual like myself, I haven't suffered too badly. It's a long story, but because of your guys' counsel and your viewpoints, and my wife and my family have done okay in spite of all the calamity that seems to surround us. So thanks again for your show, and I hope someday to be high net worth and moving on. Right now we're just, you know, college is paid for, the medical bills are paid for, and the house is paid for, that kind of stuff. And we appreciate the stability that we enjoy, and that's in some part due to you guys. So thank you very much.
Our next caller has the honor of being a first-time caller and the last caller in today's segment, and another caller from Oregon. Robert, so good to hear from you, and it's great to hear that you and your family are riding out this economic storm. Just be sure to keep preparing. This appears to be only the eye of a Category 5 typhoon. The agency you speak of is clearly the National Credit Union Administration, and this was founded about 44 years ago in 1970. As I'm sure you know, the FDIC does not have the funds to bail out even one of our top five too big to fails, which include Bank of America, Citigroup, JP Morgan, Goldman, and Wells Fargo. Each holds roughly $5 trillion in toxic debt. That's 50,000 stacks of $1 billion. Imagine 50,000 piles of $1 billion. Imagine piling $1 billion onto the front lawn of 50,000 homes. Okay, are you starting to visualize what we're talking about? But that's just the tip of the iceberg, because there's five more. So now you have to stack $1 billion on the front lawn of 250,000 American homes. Covering the front yards gives you an idea how much money our banks own. Worse still, according to Michael Snyder at the Economic Collapse blog, 1,400 of our small banks have closed their doors only since 2008. Now think of the solid jobs evaporated, gone forever, the lack of local income and oversight. You know, it used to be when we took out a mortgage or a loan, well, the lender shook your hand. They knew about your background. They knew that you had been stable in the community for a while, and you had a very solid chance of making the loan good, paying back regularly. Not anymore. You know, nothing frightened, I think, our nation's founders like concentrated wealth and power. They did everything they could to spread it around, and now here we are again with a handful of oligarchs, a fascist government, or at least a pseudo-fascist government, and an impending currency collapse. All could have been avoided if we had stuck to our guns and stopped the central bank from Jekyll Island and insisted on a bimetallic standard, similar to that proposed by Hugo Salinas Price. And once again, if you heard that fascist or pseudo-fascist government comment, and maybe you're shaking your head thinking that sounds extreme, here's really a quick synopsis as to how it's come to pass. Sure, we have a Congress, we have a separation of powers between the executive branch, the legislative branch, and of course the judicial branch. But do we really have separation from the Treasury and the Federal Reserve? Maybe we'll call it the monetary branch. That's part of this problem. But the real problem, and I probably will get nasty grams from this, well, in my opinion, it comes down to the way that power is brokered in D.C. Think about it for just one moment. If you are a powerful special interest, you have millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars in your slush fund. Obviously, the number one supporter of the representatives in your area, and you essentially, your funds are a primary reason why they can afford the campaign that gets them elected and reelected. You see how this works? It really is that power brokering that has undermined and leads us to a pseudo-fascist economy. Am I saying we have to toss the whole system out? No, I don't think so. I'm not advocating revolution, okay, or anarchy. But I am saying huge overhauls must be put in place. I'm sorry, but contributions have to be monitored better, and they have to be better regulated. And that's really all there is to it. Okay, so off my soapbox and back to the main point here. Since the federal credit unions have limited investment authority and cannot register as broker-dealers, they are essentially regulated by our former Glass-Steagall Act. Remember, the fall of that act, the fall of that legislation, is what is at the heart of our latest Great Depression. Credit unions cannot place wild bets with other people's money. With virtually no oversight, get leveraged 50 or 100 to 1 or greater, putting the entire nation and even the global economy at risk. I'd like to know what our listeners think, but I really do think that Robert has raised such an important point here. He may have even stumbled onto a unique solution that could help stem the tide of the inevitable financial crisis. A credit union-based system. What do you guys think? I'd like to hear from you. Thanks, Robert. All right, that's all the time we have for this week's Q&A session. We do want to hear from you, though. Why not pick up the phone? Give us a call. You can do so right now. You can do so tomorrow morning. You can do so at 3 a.m. in the morning from your yacht in Florida. We have one listener who's listening right now from his yacht in Florida, and you know who you are. So give us a call, 1-800-507-6531. 1-800-507-6531. I'd like for you to jot this down, put it on a post-it pad next to your phone, or plug it and program it right into your cell phone and home phone. The number again, 800-507-6531. It is no cost to you whatsoever in the contiguous United States and probably parts of Canada. You can call anytime you like. You can cancel, delete, and re-record if you didn't get it just right. And you can remain anonymous if you choose to do so. We'd like to hear from you, and we'd like for you to stay with us here at Goldseek.